Time to take a look at the world of science today. Science research, science education, all things science with Bassam Shakashiri, UW-Madison Professor of Chemistry, and William T. Evu, Distinguished Chair for the Wisconsin IDEA. Pleased to have him along, and certainly we hope you will join in as we visit with him about a whole range of things. Bassam, welcome back. Nice to have you with us again.
Happy to be here, Larry.
Let me give the phone number, 1-800-642-1234, or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call if something comes to your mind. And, you know, one of the people you might call or make comment about is Don Herbert. Don Herbert recently died.
Yes, 2 weeks ago, Mr. Wizard. Don Herbert, a native of neighboring Minnesota who actually studied at UW-La Crosse when it was a state teacher's college. Mr. Wizard introduced millions of people, including myself, to the joy of science. Don died at age 89 in California. He had a long and a good life, but his influence lasts way beyond what he did during his lifetime. Mr. Wizard was a very, very effective communicator of science. And I dedicated one of my chemical demonstrations books to him, Larry, and dedication reads to Don Herbert, television's Mr. Wizard, who perfected the art of communicating science to kids of all ages.
Wow.
He really influenced not only youngsters but adults. And I know in our listening audience there are people who watched Mr. Wizard, and as you say, perhaps they'll call in and share with us a bit of the experiences that they've had watching him on television and even listening to him on the radio. He was all over the place.
Yeah, he was an outstanding teacher. You could always tell he was vitally interested and excited about every project that he worked on with the children.
And you could one of my first impressions when I came with my parents to the United States in 1957, one of my first impressions of television was watching this man doing a live science program on television, and I could tell he was not only enjoying it, he was learning as he was going along.
Mm-hmm.
That has made a lasting impression on me, and I can tell you there are many phrases and many approaches that I have been using for many years that I learned from Mr. Wizard.
Yeah.
It's really a fabulous legacy that he has left, and there are practitioners of science and engineering all over the country, indeed around the world, who became scientists because they were inspired and motivated by what Don Herbert did as television's Mr. Wizard.
I hope you let him know that you were dedicating the book to him.
Of course. He and I have been in correspondence for the past 27, almost 30 years. I saw him at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, Connecticut, less than 10 years ago, when he and I were receiving awards, presidential citation awards from Sacred Heart University. And I have a picture of him and the two of us. You know, I cherish that.
Uh-huh.
I had dedicated my volume 4 of Chemical Demonstrations to him in 1992. So, of course, he knew about it. And we were good friends, and I always looked up to him, and I always admired what he has done. And as I say, myself was very inspired by what he was teaching everyone, including myself.
Yeah. The talking about programs, the Talk Radio Network of commercial stations has been running a weekend program called Science Fantastic. And I'm not sure the pronunciation of the person's name. Michio Taku, I think it is.
Yes. He's a Japanese-American. He is born in the United States, so went to school here, and was educated at a variety of institutions of higher education. He is a professor at the City University of New York, and he's interested in communicating science, and he does it via the radio, even though he's been featured on some television programs.
Mm-hmm.
Not only nationally, but around the world. And what this is a live 3-hour program, call-in program on Saturday evening. And I have not listened to it, but I have read about it and I've talked to people who listen to it. I think it's a good attempt to make science more accessible to the public and to help the public develop a bigger sense of appreciation of recent developments in science. And it is, you know, he does some of the same things that you and I do on your program here.
That's
he
exactly
takes
right.
in questions and. I don't know if he follows up on his website like I do. I'll have to check that out. But I tell you, every time I'm on your program, Larry, I get a lot of mail from people, and not to say anything about the comments I receive in person when I'm walking on the street and with a variety of questions and also encouragement to continue to do this. So I think what this Science Fantastic program is about, I think it is. It is a good thing. We have to be careful not to engage in hype, mm-hmm. And which is hard to do now because you have all kinds of venues on the internet, YouTube and MySpace, and there's a whole rush to put things on the internet. I would urge anyone that I know to take a careful look at what's on the internet and to make your own judgment as to whether or not it is suitable for you to learn something from. There's a lot of stuff on the internet, let me put it this way, and some of it is not very good. This is something that we have to learn how to live with. What we sort out from what we see on the internet, I think, is and what we read on the internet is very important. I think that we have other programs. I mean, you know, Science Fridays on NPR, for example, mm-hmm. is a fabulous,
fabulous
program
show.
With Ira Flatow, another good friend of mine. And he, you know, he has good quality control. I mean, you know, Science Friday is the gold standard for what should mm-hmm. be happening on broadcast radio.
I would agree with you about that. And Rick in Madison has a comment or a question here, so let's take a call. Rick, hi. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
Boy, I have fond memories when I was a little kid of sitting in front of the folks' black and white Emerson TV and watching Mr. Wizard with his tie tucked into his shirt doing his scientific experiments. And I was curious if you folks know, are there any recordings in existence of any of his programs?
Yes, they are. There are many, Rick. Actually, if you do a Mr. Wizard Google search, Mr. Wizard, the first thing that comes up is his website, and it is full of information about what he has done and how some of his programs can be accessed. His family is really very keen on maintaining this legacy, and tomorrow, actually, I should have mentioned this earlier. There's a memorial service for mm-hmm. Don in California. But yes, Rick, Rick Murphy.
Yes, sir. Guilty as charged.
I know that voice.
How can we not recognize that voice, Rick? Yes, he was a fat. Yes, he tucked his shirt in. He actually be doing a live show. You know, there would be things that would happen that he had not expected. There's a famous story that he would tell himself about mixing two colorless liquids from two separate beakers into a third empty beaker, and saying ahead of time that a blue color will develop when he counted till nine. So he counted 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Nothing happened. He kept counting. and he quit around 20. And as soon as he quit, the color developed. and he, of course, being a live show, he said, well, the solutions must have been old. And indeed, when he went back and checked them out, the solutions were old. So he was really captivating, and by captivating I mean he provided not only educational value but was entertaining and captured the attention of as I say, kids of all ages. And even today, when I go back and look at some of the videos that he has made, I am just really thrilled and moved to see how relaxed he was doing it, and how when he involved youngsters, kids, you know, in doing the experiments, he was not instructing them how to do the experiment. He was exhorting them to explore and find out what happens when things are mixed together and so on. So it was,
Thanks, well, Rick.
I happen to have my copy of the complete directory to primetime TV network shows here. Would you care to hear a couple of brief lines about the nature of the program?
Sure.
As Mr. Wizard, he would show his young helper how to do interesting scientific experiments with simple things found around the house. In addition to the demonstrations, Mr. Wizard would explain the principles behind them. The original helper was Mr. Wizard's 11-year-old neighbor, a boy named Willie. By the start of the 1953-54 season, a boy and a girl alternated as Mr. Wizard's assistant. There was considerable turnover in the children who acted as his assistants, but they were all ready with an excited, "Gee, Mr. Wizard," whenever he popped out one of his tricks.
Thanks, Rick.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Rick.
Talk to you later. Glad he read that. Mary and Madison will give you a chance now. Hi, Mary. What's on your mind?
Hello. Yes, I'm hearing about capturing carbon, and I guess if I knew a little bit more about what they're talking about is, far as the environment and
sure.
I was wondering, I'll take my answer off the air if you'd care to maybe explain the carbon cycle or
Sure, I think we can talk about that.
Sure, I will try. This is a good question because this is in the news a lot now, and people like Mary would like to know more about it. So when the reference is made to capturing carbon, they're really talking about carbon dioxide. Carbon is an element. You know, charcoal is made of carbon. Wood has a lot of carbon in it. But when anything that has carbon in it burns, fossil fuels are derived from, you know, they're hydrocarbons. When they burn, they give off carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is a gas. It is invisible, has no color, and it has no smell. So it is odorless and it is colorless. And it is a major greenhouse gas. By a greenhouse gas, we mean it's a gas that traps heat that's radiated from the Earth's surface and prevents it from escaping. Everyone knows about the greenhouse effect, especially in the past few days when we've had a lot of hot weather around and you left your car closed and you walk back and open the door. It's very hot. So capturing carbon in the form of carbon dioxide is an attempt to reduce carbon dioxide emissions. And people have become a bit sloppy, let me put it that way, in saying carbon. It is really carbon dioxide gas and its contribution to the environment, to the adverse contribution to the environment. What happens is that through photosynthesis, carbon dioxide is converted back into sugars through the leaves of the plants, but that's only during the daytime. As a result of deforestation, not only in this country but elsewhere around the world, there are many fewer now forests and trees, and thus the amount of carbon dioxide gas that is emitted by us as we drive our cars and burn oil to generate electricity and other things that we need for our comfortable daily lives. We are generating more carbon dioxide than nature can accommodate. In this is fairly documented. It was controversial, and there are people who still say it is controversial, that the emission of carbon dioxide is responsible for global warming. So there are attempts politically around the world to reduce the carbon, the amount of carbon, as they call it, but it's really carbon dioxide gas. So I hope, Mary, that helps a little bit in terms of understanding what the reference is all about. It's a good thing to do, that is, to be aware of what the issues are and for all of us to think about alternative energy sources. It's very important for us to really become aware of what the issues are so that we can do our best to improve the quality of the environment where we live around the globe.
Thanks, Mary. Thanks very much for calling. Bassam Shakashiri, our guest today, UW-Madison Professor of Chemistry. I'm Larry Mailer. Jim Packard, our producer. We're talking science here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. talking science today, science research and education and the whole field of science, I guess, with Bassam Shakashiri, UW-Madison Professor of Chemistry. Thanks for listening in. Give us a call if you have a question at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. I think we have one open line, but let's go to Carl in Madison next. Carl, hi. Thank you.
I got a little frog in my throat, but I thought that Larry and Sam would be interested in hearing that. I remember the first time I ever heard of carbon dioxide was on Mr. Wizard, and it was a simple set of experiments that he did, which evolved around using baking soda and vinegar, basing an acid, and producing carbon dioxide. And I'll never forget, he had a little candle in a beaker, and he poured the carbon dioxide from that he had just produced with the baking soda and vinegar, and it poured and put out the candle.
Exactly. Carbon dioxide gas does not support combustion. I remember that experiment, too. Isn't it wonderful, Larry and Carl, how many of us are recalling these, vividly recalling these experiments. Baking soda, when you add a little bit of vinegar to it, decomposes to give you carbon dioxide gas, and carbon dioxide gas does not support combustion. So if there's a candle there, it puts out the candle. It's a very simple experiment. I would venture to say that there's hardly a kid who's done a science fair project in the past several years who has not done this experiment.
The other thing about it is that the carbon dioxide, of course, is heavier than the ambient atmosphere.
Yep.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And let's go to Raleigh in Brown Deer. Hello to you.
Good morning, Larry and the Sam. I had a question that actually I wish Scott Craven could help answer as well. In my informal discussions with outdoorsmen, sportsmen, often they don't take the problems such as chronic wasting disease or the fish virus very seriously. Or they have some erroneous information I don't know where they get it from. But this problem of their attitude and their lack of knowledge can have some real consequences in terms of our environment. And Larry, feel free to comment on that, too, if you like.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I think ignorance is the biggest enemy we have. There is a wealth of knowledge available to all of us, and how we find out reliable information and use it is really very, very important, whether it comes down to chronic wasting mm-hmm. disease or to the quality of water that we drink or to knowing what an ozone alert is all about is really very important. And that's why, you know, I'm a strong advocate of improving science literacy among the public at large. That is to get an appreciation and an understanding of what scientific accomplishments are all about and how they can be helpful to us so that they can affect us in our daily lives. You know, it includes things like nutritional information, you know, because that affects us personally. It includes exercise that we do. It includes what we do for recreation and where we do it. You know, on a hot day when there is an air quality alert and knowing what that means, we really should not be cutting the lawn then because the mowers, you know, contribute to the ozone production. And ozone, by the way, Larry, is useful in the stratosphere, in the upper atmosphere. It's the ozone layer that protects us from harmful ultraviolet radiation. But on the surface of the planet, ozone is very harmful to all living organisms. It's a powerful oxidizing agent. It grabs electrons very readily from other substances, and so yes, knowing what is useful to us can be done not only in a classroom. You know, most of what we learn, we don't learn it in the classroom. We learn it after the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
Most of what we learn in life, we learn after the classroom. In the classroom, we learn how to learn. And if we keep using that information and we seek reliable sources of information, including websites, I don't want anybody to get the idea that websites are not reliable, but you have to be careful in sorting out what you're reading on the website or what you're watching on television or what you're hearing on radio or what you're reading in the newspaper. You have to be focused on discerning what is reliable. I think all of these pieces of information will help us enjoy the quality of life and really be better responsible citizens in our local communities and elsewhere as well.
I'll just give what Raleigh asked me for a comment. I'll just give you one quick comment. It's just a little experience I had one time, and it goes along with what you were saying. I was camping at a lake in northern Wisconsin and visiting with some campers nearby who said, well, the DNR now is netting muskie out of this small lake and moving them to the south of Wisconsin, and isn't this a terrible thing? So I said, well, that's hard to believe. I was really having trouble believing that. So when I got home, I got on the phone and I called the DNR office in northern Wisconsin and asked them about it. And they said, well, no, we netted some muskie, but we were putting transmitters on them to study them. Actually, we put muskie in that lake every year. So the next year I went back camping there and I'm hearing the same story. And I said, well, you know, I called the Department of Natural Resources on this. Well, the people I talked to still didn't believe me.
It was
a little bit of a I felt a little bad that they didn't, but it's an example. Sometimes.
It is a good example, and it points out to the collective responsibility we all have. It is actually part of the responsibility, in this case of DNR, to explain even more fully what they're doing so that people are eager to learn. I mean, very few people that I know are closed-minded about anything. There are some that are. So the more reliable information that we have, the better knowledge we acquire, and then it enriches our conversations. It alters our attitudes. It makes us more responsible, not only to ourselves, but to the environment that we're in. So thank you, Raleigh.
And I wish in that case they had put up a little sign. You know, all they had done was put up a little sign explaining what was going on, and that would have helped. Tony and Juno, it's your turn. Hi, Tony.
Hi there. Say hi, Sam. Say, I'm wondering about the difference between the words hypothesis and theory, you know, that scientists use all the time. And keep in mind that, you had mentioned engaging in hype and, you know, getting reliable sources. And the more that people start to study, you know, hypotheses, and then they start to quote them as theory, and it seems like many of the things I read, they're quoting theory long before the facts are proven. And I wanted your opinion on that.
That's a good question, Tony. Thank you for asking it. And I will you'll forgive me if I suggest to begin with something really obvious to do, and that is to look up both words in the dictionary and see what the dictionary says about their meaning. There's more than one meaning to each word. But a hypothesis is something that is, I'm going to use another word now, postulated or presented and can be tested by seeing how observable facts can be reconciled with what has been said. A theory, that's a very profound question that you're really asking. I mean, this is a very good question. A theory is a collection of organized ideas about facts. Theories come and go. Let me put it this way. Mm-hmm. Theories are put together to help explain in a rational way observations about a natural phenomenon that has been occurred, and then if more observations are made and they're not consistent with the theory, that means they cannot be explained by this theory. Then anyone with a scientific mind starts thinking about revising that theory. So theories are not static. There are theories that get discarded every day. A theory is based on observations, on ways by which we can rationalize and explain the observations in a coherent way, and theories are tested all the time. There is no solid, so to speak, theory that is irrevocable. There are facts, and how the facts are put together into certain theories, that's a different story.
Yeah.
The facts are, we have to establish what the facts are. We have to agree on the facts. you know, there's an old saying that before you distort the facts, you have to learn what the facts are. but that applies to political theories and other things. So Tony, I think it's a very good question. And you know what I'm going to do when I get off the air here? I am going to go to the dictionary and, again, look carefully at the meaning of those two words, because it is very important that in the language that we use, that we communicate with each other as effectively as possible. So there are theories that are called, for example, a theory of evolution. Mm-hmm. It is not a hypothetical situation that's being described here. It is actually a coherent collection of observations and conclusions based on these observations that we call a theory of evolution. There used to be a theory of gravity. A long time ago, there was a theory that said that the sun goes around the earth.
Yeah.
That was a theory. It was disproven by observations and by sharp mental processes that said Galileo and others, especially Galileo, said no. It's not that way. It's that the earth rotates, goes around the sun. So the interplay between theory, facts, and observations is at the very heart of what science and science research is all about.
Thanks, Tony. Appreciate it very much. And Pauline in Roseville, Minnesota, I think it's your turn next. Hi, Pauline.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'd like to have you elaborate on Mary's original question. What are ways that carbon dioxide can be captured? And then after it's captured, so what? Can it be broken down into things that would, so that if it was released, if the elements were released back into the atmosphere, they wouldn't be harmful anymore? Or what can be done with captured carbon?
Very good question, Pauline. There are plants, for example, that try to use scrubbers to catch the carbon dioxide. That's a heating plant, for example, to catch the not only the carbon dioxide but also some of the sulfur dioxide that's emitted from the combustion of coal, because coal is about usually 1% sulfur and emits sulfur dioxide. So, but carbon dioxide, yes, can be captured. The question is it economically viable to capture the carbon dioxide, and what effect will that have on the cost of the energy that's being produced? There are international treaties that have been agreed to, I would say quickly, mostly by countries not including the United States, about carbon dioxide emission. And they deal with not only reducing the emission, but also what to do with the carbon dioxide that is captured. You know, as we breathe, we emit a little bit of carbon dioxide, but that doesn't contribute to altering the balance of carbon dioxide gas in the environment. What contributes adversely to the balance of carbon dioxide gas in the environment is our overdependence worldwide on fossil fuels as a very useful and inexpensive source of energy. That's going to run out sometime, not in my lifetime, but that's going to happen. And what we want to do is capture the carbon dioxide and put it to other good uses. Carbon dioxide, to break it down back to carbon and oxygen, yes, that can be done chemically. But again, the question is that economically viable? And what are you going to do with the carbon? What are you going to do with the oxygen? So all of these are great questions that a lot of people not only think about, but a lot more people should think about.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Pauline. Appreciate it. Marvin in Stevens Point, we turn to you now. Hi, Marv.
Good morning.
Morning.
And good morning, Bassam.
Hi, Marv.
Excellent comments on Don Herbert. I really appreciated those comments. As you know, Bassam, I was on the ACS board, and in 1994, we gave him the Grady Sack Award. And at the luncheon that was in his honor, I still remember his ability, even amongst professionals, to captivate us with discussions and even in a restaurant, an experiment.
Yes, that's I remember that, too. I was there. This is Professor Emeritus of Chemistry Marvin Lang from UW-Stevens Point. He himself, an excellent communicator of science as well. And Don Herbert had a great influence, even in his 80s, on all of us. Yes, I remember that. 1994, it was in San Diego,
correct.
Right? And he was still talking about new ways and new approaches. You know, he never lived in the past. He always talked about what should be done now, what can we do now, and how we can build on what has happened before. So I appreciate hearing from you, Marv, on this commemoration of the legacy of Don Herbert, Mr. Wizard.
Thanks, Marv.
You're welcome.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. Steve in Wonder Lake, Illinois. Turn to you now. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, good morning, gentlemen. I'm one of those people who grew up with Mr. Wizard and have just recently retired from a 35-year career as an electrical engineer, and I still enjoy thinking of some of these experiments. And if I'm given the opportunity to get a little dry ice, I'm likely to try something with it. Two items. One, my recollection that I recall of his show was where he put a bottle of carbonated beverage in an ultrasonic cleaner. And when he turned it on, of course, all of that carbon dioxide immediately came out of solution and it shot up to the ceiling. That's a very memorable demonstration. I've never done that myself. But
Steve, excuse me for interrupting. Does that in any way remind you of the current craze, I should say, that people have with dropping Mentos into a Diet Coke?
I wasn't going to bring that up because I wanted to stay brief, but I've seen that on the Ghost, on the MythBusters, and that MythBusters show, although they get a little off on the tangent, they kind of approach what I think Don Herbert did in the past. Another thing that I wanted to bring up, and I still have a number of my kits during that same era, there was a service called Things of Science. Are you familiar with that?
Yes.
I still have some of those kits, and just for their listening audience, every month I would get a little box, a little blue and yellow box, with some sort of scientific experiment in it. I know one of them had an actual little chunk of synthetic sapphire. One of them was fasteners, and it had a bunch of different kinds of screws and nuts and bolts. There was one, I think, on feathers, all kinds of fascinating little experiments that you would get, and it would lead you through the steps to do that. And I still have some of those. And I know that someone else tried to carry that on, but I assume they're out of business now. Is that correct?
Well, it's very hard to get kits like this now. There are all kinds of regulations, and there are all kinds of fear of selling kits that have so-called chemicals in them. You know,
yes.
Steve, you name me something around us that is not chemical in nature.
Yeah,
you
right.
Name me one thing. Anyway, there is this phobia about the word chemical. Don't misunderstand. There are chemicals that are hazardous or dangerous. We have to be very, very careful in handling them. Wired magazine had a story last year, a long story. I was interviewed for it, that was bemoaning the lack of access to youngsters for chemistry kits. This is something that we miss. Of course, there is now a lot of simulation of such things on television, on computers, but it's not the same thing as doing it yourself.
No.
And this
exactly.
is what this is the point that I really want to mention here. I try to come close to it a bit earlier about what's on MySpace and YouTube and so on. They're mostly experiments where something blows up or something potentially can endanger the person who's doing it. You know, what do you learn from that? Mr. Wizard, he did some experiments with fire. He did them in a very careful and responsible fashion. He had the kids wear goggles. He wore goggles himself. Mm-hmm. He was very careful in really providing educational knowledge and not just a whiz-bang or a gee-whiz type thing. Don't
right.
get me wrong. I like gee-whiz things.
Yeah, you do some gee-whiz things.
But they are a way to capture people's attention, and then what you do with them is what's important next. So
one could easily argue that a program of that nature actually helps educate us so that we don't get into trouble in trying experiments that might be dangerous, because we would learn the boundaries of where safety is and where safety isn't ahead of time.
Yeah, and I tell you what, speaking of safety, and blowing things up and so forth. I promised at the start of the show or before I even started talking with Bassam that I would ask him about fireworks. And some of the fireworks these days, Bassam, are really intriguing. You'll get a firework will explode and there's a heart or some kind of neat shape. And I've often wondered exactly how they do that sort of thing.
Fireworks are fascinating. This is, you know, goes way back to the old days of the Chinese who've allegedly or supposedly invented fireworks. They are basically combustion reactions that have gone out of control. but they're carefully packaged. It is really a fine art. There are companies that make these fireworks. I would urge everyone to enjoy firework shows and firework displays and to minimize, I would say, avoid setting them off yourself because of the inherent potential danger. It is very important to learn something about how the fireworks work. And on my website, if you go to my website, you will see we're featuring now in the upper right corner on the front page fireworks. And in it, we explain a little bit how these computer-designed fireworks and how they're set off by computers end up giving you these beautiful shapes that are up in the air. It's a heart, for example, as you say. Sometimes there's a facsimile of what looks like a flag. Mm-hmm. There are all kinds of things that are up there. They're colorful. Mm-hmm. They use ordinary chemicals, but they are explosives. They are dangerous. They are fun to watch, and I urge everyone, especially in the Madison area this weekend at Warner Park, where about 300,000 people are going to gather to enjoy the show and look up in the sky and remember what this fireworks display is really about. It is about celebrating Independence Day. It's about celebrating the 4th of July. So the answer to your question, Larry, yes, they are carefully designed so that they produce the desired effect, and they are enjoyable because they give off light energy, they give off a lot of heat energy, but we're far away from them, we don't see that, and they give off a lot of sound energy. That's because the energy from the explosive mixture is being released faster than it can be dissipated by its immediate environment, so it generates a sound wave. But I always like to say, as I have already said, for us to really remember what we are celebrating. We're celebrating Independence Day. We're celebrating freedom. We're celebrating liberty. It's very, very important. I don't want to get too emotional about this, but I am. We really live in the best and the country in the history of humankind, and we want to keep it that way. And I want everybody to have not only brats and other refreshments, but also enjoy the fireworks themselves.
Oh, thank you very much, Bassam. And I want to go to Bassam's website if you want to learn some more about those fireworks and a lot of other things. He has experiments on his website. He has lots of things that you will enjoy looking at. And the address for that is www.scifun.org. That's SCIFUN, scifun.org. You're going to enjoy it and everything that he's got on that website. Thanks again, Bassam. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Larry. And if you have questions, we'll be happy to answer them. We answer all questions except homework questions.
So if you've got a question other than a homework question, you can post that question at scifun.org, SCIFUN.org. Bassam Shakashiri, he'll be back soon, and we'll talk more with him about science, research, and education. We're going to educate you a little bit about antiques, appraisals, and auctions. Shirley Bauman, one of our often regular guests here, auctioneer, certified appraiser, next year on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.